Hello and welcome to the Negative Positives Podcast, episode 358. I'm your host, Mike Gutterman, coming from the Gutterman Cave here in Louisville, Kentucky. And it's a Monday show. We had a week off and everybody's just longing for us at this point. And so we're just happy to be back. And let's get to our co-captains first. We have some guests tonight, some awesome guests. But let's get to our co-captains first, all the way out in La La Land, the City of Angels, Los Angeles, California. Mr. Andre Dominguez, how are you tonight, Andre?
I'm doing very well, Mike. And as some listeners may know, it was Mike's birthday, and so in honor of the old man, I am drinking some Old Foe, the first whiskey that Mrs. Gutterman introduced me to, and part of what landed me on the floor of the Gutterman Cave back in, when was it, 2018, 2017?
Yeah, so, it's been a bit. Yeah. Very nice. I had somebody, a friend gave me a bottle of Four Roses small batch bourbon for my birthday, so it was quite tasty. I'm gonna do beer tonight, because when I do bourbon during the recording of these podcasts, I tend to take a really long time to edit them afterwards. But all right, let's get to our other co-captain. It is Miss Jessica Jones out in the greater Richmond, Virginia area. Jessica, how you doing tonight?
I'm pretty good. Had a really nice day. It's my Saturday, so I'm excited to get to podcasting. Glad we have these pretty cool guests on today, even though we're outnumbered, I should say, by the West Coast crew. That's true. But I think it'll be pretty good.
Awesome. Well, let's get to our guests. These guys, you know, they've just taken over the podcasting world by storm, one of the hottest trends in film podcasting. And so they got a little show called I Dream of Cameras. And boy, are we going to get really gassy here tonight. And if you heard anything about the pre-recording, I got a little gassy right before we started recording, because I made the bad choice of eating oysters in Louisville, Kentucky. And So there you go. I think it's all fitting. But so let's get to our guest from I Dream of Cameras podcast. It is on the Sunny 16 Presents feed. If you're looking for it, let's start out with Jeff Greenstein. Jeff, how you doing tonight?
Good, Mike. Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I think this is going to be a fun one. Everybody's got liquor. It's going to probably go off the rails, but that probably wouldn't be much different than most of our episodes. So I think we're good. So, and then our other guest, the other co-captain of the I Dream of Cameras podcast. This is a guy I actually had on my list to have on. Oh, I don't know about. He was like the next person I was going to hit up. Then I hear that he's on the Sunny 16 Presents feed. I was like, what? I can't have him now. Can't have him. You know, I just, it's just going to look like I'm copying Sunny 16 now. Like I'm just following on their coattails. So I finally decided that, I could do this. So I'm going to finally welcome Mr. Gabe Sachs. Gabe, how you doing tonight, sir?
So well, thank you so much for having us. Love the show. Listen for a long time, as you know.
Oh, very, very cool. Very cool. It's our pleasure. So, and I've listened to every episode of I Dream of Cameras. So, you know,
that's so exciting.
Yeah. You know, I like to spread the love, you know, but, so, all right. I guess since this is your all's first time, you know, if they can always go back and listen to your all's, first, episode or whatever, first couple episodes, and kind of get an idea of where you guys got into photography and got into all this madness. But, just for those that haven't maybe checked those episodes out, just to give a little context, just a little bit about how you got into this film photography madness. Just a little bit about yourselves. We'll start with Jeff.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm a redneck intellectual like Mike Gutterman. And it was at summer camp that I first took a photography class when I was like 8 or 9 years old, and learned to do darkroom work, learned to shoot, learned to use a light meter, and became immediately fascinated with photography. And by the second session of summer camp, I pretended I was allergic to horses so I could take two sessions of photography instead of one. And have been fascinated with cameras and photography ever since.
Nice. So those horse allergies, they're a real bear, which doesn't even make any sense, but all right, Gabe, how about you?
I grew up in Riverdale, New York, and there was a dark room in my basement, and I think around, I guess, 6 years old, I went into the dark room and my brother was developing some pictures, and that was it. You know, the magic of seeing a picture come to life out of nothing. I was fascinated, and my dad was into photography when he was younger, and then my sister's a great photographer, so I just, you know, naturally got into it and borrowed a camera, and that was pretty much it.
Very, very cool. And like how just kind of as another little context here, how long has it been since have you guys always been into film? Did you ever leave it, or have you just come back in the last several years? Where you stand with that stuff?
I've always been into it, and when I use digital, I'm always, you know, cursing myself. So there you go.
Yeah, I've always been into it as well. And I think I had a renaissance of interest in film photography around the time my son was born, which was 23 years ago. And that coincided with a time when people were offloading all their film equipment. And so you could get inexpensive, high-end 35mm, large format, 120 cameras on eBay very inexpensively. And so I basically went and cherry-picked my way through all the cameras I had coveted when I was 12, 13, 14 years old. You could pick up a Nikon F for $20. And so that sort of fired my interest in trying as many different kinds of cameras as I could. I have a iPhone, and I finally bought my first new digital camera in 10 years a few months ago. But it just does not excite me the way that film photography always has.
Very cool. How did you guys kind of come together? This might even be asked in some of the questions, but I'll just make sure. How did you guys come together and decide to start a podcast? And I'm guessing part of it, the reason why you're on the Sunny 16 Presents feed is because you get Graham to do all the hard work. Is that
exactly.
Gabe and I are both television writers and producers and directors, and Gabe has also written a couple of movies. Our careers have sort of run along parallel tracks for the last 25 years or so. We had a passing acquaintance with one another, having shared the same studio lot and having had a number of mutual friends over the years. And a friend of mine said to me recently, just in the last like year or two, said, "Do you know this guy, Gabe Sachs? He always has a Leica M6 over his shoulder. I feel like you should know this guy." And of course, I remembered meeting Gabe when I was a neophyte showrunner back in the mid 90s. And so I reached out to him, and we met for lunch at a local coffee shop. And it turned into 4 hours of talking about cameras and pulling cameras out of a bag and going, "Oh my God, I can't believe you have that. Oh my God, I can't believe you have that." And that sort of renewed our acquaintance. And then, you know, when Sunny 16 put the word out about a year ago about wanting to build the Sunny 16 Presents feed as a channel for listener-generated content, I wanted to do a podcast that was about loving cameras. But, you know, it's kind of, we don't ever talk about gas on the podcast. I actually am sort of opposed to the idea of gas because gas seems to imply that acquiring new cameras is a bad thing and that it won't change your photography. But I think Gabe will agree with me that it will change your photography.
Yeah.
Bring out different parts of you as an artist. And that is sort of the sub theme of I Dream of Cameras. It's talking about the different cameras we love and how they've changed the work that we do.
I totally agree. And, you know, I remember when I started this podcast, and I would hear people say at the time, you know, a whole lot of film podcasts were kind of popping up, and people were like, "Man, I'm just kind of tired of people talking about gear all the time. I kind of want to hear about the process and the artistic side of it." And I'm always like, you know, I bet you, like, I've tried to listen to some podcasts that wasn't necessarily film podcasts, but were like art podcasts or whatever, even photography podcasts, and they can concentrate on the process and you know, after like three episodes, I'm kind of like, yeah, I'm kind of done. I wish they'd talk about some gear or something. I don't know. I'm kind of like, I don't know. So I think there's different flavors for everyone out there, but I appreciate a very gear centric podcast. But and speaking of, like, I agree with your sentiment about new cameras not influencing your photography. I totally agree with that, because I've made this the same sort of correlation with guitars. Every time I get a new guitar, I feel like there's like immediately like 20 new licks, hot guitar licks, kind of just pop out, you know, because it feels different. It feels different from what you're used to playing, and it makes you play something a little differently or approach something a little differently. And I think different cameras can do the same thing. You know, just the way a camera feels, where maybe the advance lever is, all these little things play into, like, maybe just influencing your photography a little bit differently. So, yeah. But okay, well, anybody have anything else for them before we move on?
No, I'm just excited for them to validate all my recent purchases. So let's
there. Yes. Can't wait.
Awesome. Well, we're going to learn a whole lot more about it. That's kind of a very brief introduction to these two fine gentlemen, but we're going to learn a whole lot more because we have a ton of Facebook questions to these guys, and so we're going to try to make this first segment as short as we can so we can get as many questions to them from the fine people of the Facebook group. So let's go ahead and kind of get into what we've been up to lately, and we'll start as always with Mr. Andre Dominguez. Andre, what have you been up to, brother?
Oh boy, where to begin? Positives and negatives, as is the whole you know nature of our podcast. It's been some great time recently, I think, for my photography in terms of trying to get out there and actually practice it, put myself a little bit out of my comfort zone. But like, you know, I do have to be real and say that it has also been something that's been helping me recover from a really painful and sad breakup. Different periods of your life are kind of marked by different things, and photography, I think, for a lot of people can function as a source of comfort and therapy, and so it's been nice to go out there, try to stay positive and shoot some cool film photos. This past weekend, myself and a buddy of mine, Alan Escalante, went out to the desert, and pretty much from 9 a.m. to about 10 p.m. was when I got back home. We were just driving around the desert looking for cool things to photograph. I decided to bring only medium and large format, and you know, really, really forced myself to spend a lot of time on a tripod, which is something that I'm not super duper used to doing. Working with the monorail, figuring out how to use my dark cloth, which sounds like a really obvious thing. You just put it over the camera, but I learned so many tricks from Alan, who's a really, really accomplished large format photographer of my own age, which I thought was, I mean, we've been friends for a little while now. We met each other a few months ago, but that was also really something interesting about having a friend who's at like a similar stage of life, dealing with his own, you know, changes in his career, you know, things happening in his personal life.
Puberty, like, and all that stuff.
Arctic to be able to share that experience with a friend of my own age and learn so many skills from him on the large format photography side of things. And I'll be honest, there's been a little bit of retail therapy happening, and I'll get into more of that later, I'm sure, as we get into the nitty gritty of cameras and things like that. But bought some new stuff, and I'm excited to continue to test it out. And Mike Kukovica is already in town. Again, it feels like it was just yesterday. So this weekend, we're going to be heading back out to the desert. One of the things that's on our to-do list is the shooting that the church in Kill Bill out there in the desert. I don't know exactly
cool.
where.
Nice.
That'll be fun. We've gotten permission from the owner, and we'll be doing some medium and large format stuff there.
Awesome. So I guess what we're really taking from this entire conversation is, ladies, Andre's back on the market. And, so, oh, the look on his face. Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to, is that all you wanted to get out? Andre, you saving the rest for later. Is it that what
yeah.
you're doing?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Jess, what have you been up to?
I can't remember. But I went, well, we didn't record last week. I went home to Florida to see my family. It's been over a year since I've seen my parents and 2 years since we had all been together with my sibling and her family too. So got to do that. And that was really awesome since we're all vaccinated and I just hadn't gotten to hug anybody in so long. So that was really great. Got to shoot a little while I was down there. I wish I could shoot more, but we were South Florida this time, so I didn't have my car, and I did a little bit. So I developed some of it and developed the last of some roles today too, so I'm pretty excited to see those. And I really just can't wait to kind of get out there. I booked some trips upcoming. I'll be in Seattle next month, so I'm hoping to shoot some more then, and then back to Florida, and then I'll be in Iceland in August for the third time. Yeah, they just opened up to vaccinated Americans, and they're like the only place. I can't even go to Canada, but I can go to Iceland. Yeah, so
I love Iceland.
Yeah, it's my favorite place. So this will be my third time going, and I'm just really excited because everything's very cheap over there right now, because I'm sure they're hurting for tourism. So I'm pretty pumped. So I've got a lot of plans for photography, so I'm excited. But that's pretty much all I've done is work and go see my fam. And cool. Andre, Mike and I need to get out there and take you out on the town. And we'll,
That's right.
We'll find those ladies for you.
I can be a heck of a wingman, you know?
Yeah. So, we got to get Roxana in on this. We got to get Jeff and Gabe in on this. We'll have a whole West Coast gathering. I think we need to do it.
All I want, Jess, is a hug from all of you. That's all I need. It's all the affection and you know, genuine relationship I need right now.
Oh, we could do a group hug. I'm all about a hug. I've been known for my hugs. I'll say that.
Oh, yeah. Look out.
Not in any kind of weird way. I'm just a hugger.
All right, so let's move on to Jeff. What have you been up to lately? You got anything you've been kind of getting yourself into?
Oh, golly. It's going to seem like I'm copying Andre, but I just broke up with my girlfriend,
too. You
really are. Broken heart. This isn't even fair. It's like,
let's go grab a note.
Yeah, I'm not even joking. I actually just, my girlfriend of 3 years and I broke up a few weeks ago. And so,
I'm so sorry. I laughed. I thought it was a joke.
It's been rough. No, actually true. It's funny. I'm commiserating. I feel you, Andre. I really feel you. But the good news is that the television business is starting to wake up a little bit. And I do feel that like things are starting to thaw and there seems to be more of an interest in moving back into production, which means that writing has started to wake up. I got a couple of projects that have been gestating for a while that all of a sudden are demanding a lot of time, which is terrific. Also, the podcast has fired our acquisitions. And so I think Gabe and I tend to feed on each other and validate each other. You know, we text each other all hours saying, is it okay if I buy this on eBay or that on eBay? What do you think? Should I do it? And the answer is always yes. So I recently acquired two cameras that I just love. One is a Widelux, which is just amazing and so much fun to shoot with. And I'm just enjoying like learning, putting that camera through its paces. It's fascinating. And then I got a Rolleiflex SL350, which is a very rare SLR, 35 millimeter SLR that Rolleiflex made. And it has a beautiful 50 millimeter planar lens that just renders gorgeously. And so I've been shooting with that as much as I can. I've been out on the bike paths of LA and the beach towns and so forth with my camera shooting. And then of course, Gabe and I are recording a lot. We try and pump out a new episode every other week. We just recorded a new one the other night. We have one coming out late this week, which is called Disasterama, which is about photographic disasters and was inspired by the breakup. So,
what's this episode going to be about?
Right. Yeah. That's what I'm up to.
You and I, with regards to photography and breakups, have a little bit of history, because the very, very cool APS camera that you gave me, the only reason why I have not touched it yet is because the roll inside there were some of the last pictures that I took of my previous partner.
Oh, no. So
there's a lot of fraught memories.
Yeah, I had that experience.
But at some point, I need some more healing time before I touch that camera, just in case you felt that it was being neglected.
I hear you.
So what would APS stand for in your case, Andre? Like anti-partner system or something?
Oh, no.
I'm wondering, because didn't you messed up some rolls from your previous girlfriend, and then you had a problem with some rolls with this most recent girlfriend?
In every single like serious long-term relationship that I have had, I have ruined important rolls. First vacations, my birthday, like you
it's kind of like the ring when you see that video and then you know you're going to die. And so this is your sign.
That's it.
Yeah, if you ever mess, if you're dating someone and you mess up a roll of film, just break up with them right then. You know it's not going to work.
It's over.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's the problem.
Gabe, how have you been doing? Let's transition this conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, things are good. I mean, as Jeff was saying, things are starting to start, you know, move again in TV and film. We have I have a producing writing partner named Jeff as well. And we have a couple shows. One we are waiting for. One is going to be in production in the summer. But the best thing about this time right now is there's a lot of actor friends that are hanging out and love to take pictures. So I have a friend, Kayla Yule, who's on a show called Roswell now, and she's commuting back and forth to Santa Fe so that we'll go shoot. So we shot last week, and we're going to shoot again tomorrow. And the other thing is I'm always the problem. I have trouble sleeping, so I am naturally looking on every kind of photo site I can and see and go, oh, that's a really cool shot. What lens is it? Oh, and then Jeff will, of course, text me at that time. And I said, oh, my gosh, I just pressed buy it now. You just called me and I just pressed. And so, but then it'll be things like, all of a sudden, I'll go down the rabbit hole. I saw this Volna 3 Russian lens, and I saw all these amazing portraits, and then had to know everything about it, and then had to buy one. And then it said it had a Pentacon 6, you know, mount. I was so excited, and I got it, and of course, it didn't work. And then contact Arax, the Russian camera. And they said, no, it's not going to work. You need an adapter. I buy the adapter, put it on the lens, put it on my camera. And if you just bumped into me slightly, the lens would pop off.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so I wrote to Eric's and I said, oh, my gosh, this is what's happening. They said, yes, exactly. That's a little peculiarity of the lens. That was the end of it.
It's built in. It's part of the design.
It's built in. It's part of the fun. Yeah,
auto ejecting lens.
Exactly it. Yeah. That's exactly what happens.
All right. Well, is everybody? Is that pretty much all you got, Gabe?
Yeah. Just keep buying stuff. That's my problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, as far as me, I did do a little bit of photography. I don't know if I talked about this on the show. I had to take. Did I, Andre? Correct me or stop me if I mentioned this, but I had to take some senior portraits of my son for his yearbook because this COVID and everything, like they gave you the option of not having like the school photo, whoever they hired to take, you could just take a portrait, like a head and shoulders portrait of your son. And I was like, well, that would be kind of cooler anyway. So I put out like my digital camera because I wanted to make sure I got the shot because, we had only like 5 days to turn this photo in. And and I know that I'm not that quick on film developing. I'm a little bit of a slacker there. So did the digital. And my camera developed this issue, and it's apparently common with some Pentax cameras. It's called aperture block syndrome. And like it won't open up the aperture to the proper thing. And I kept getting all these really dark pictures. I couldn't figure it out. And so apparently I have a problem with my digital camera that I just bought literally like a year and a half ago or something like that. Not real happy about it, and not real happy about the Ricoh ownership of Pentax. It doesn't seem like this is not the Pentax I'm used to. So I mean, this camera probably has less than like 500 actuations on it, you know, and like and it's already developed this issue, and I'm really kind of ticked about it. And apparently this has been a common thing with a lot of their models over the last 4 or 5 years, and they still haven't fixed it, and I think that's just a travesty, you know. But so yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do. I've heard that I can buy like a newer lens. There's like a KA4 mount or something like that, that apparently doesn't use the aperture block in the camera to do the aperture. It's some sort of electronic thing or something. And maybe I can buy one of those lenses and continue to use the camera, even with this faulty aperture block, whatever this thing is. So yeah, I'm a little bummed about that, but so we end up taking an iPhone 12 shots and iPhone 11 shots and getting it done that way. And they were fine, but I just couldn't really kind of get I mean, yeah, they came out okay. You know, I mean, it's fine. These iPhones are pretty damn good these days. But so we did it that way. But it just made me mad. You know, I have a legitimate use for the digital camera, and I have pulled it out for the first time since like our Florida trip last summer, and it's just developed this problem. And so not real happy about that. But as far as film, I did shoot a little bit of film on when my son just went back to school. They do like they're doing like 2 days of school a week. And so his first day of his senior year, first real day of actually going to school, and it's his senior year of high school, I had to grab a little compact camera. And of course, he's walking to the bus stop in complete darkness. I mean, it is completely dark. And I was like, so I pull out this little compact camera. I was like, well, I'm just going to have to blow the hell out of him with flash in the middle of the night. So I got some pictures of him walking to the bus stop on his first day back to his senior year of high school. And I'm sure they're going to be awful. He's going to be like, you know, completely blown out and red eyes and all this other stuff. I mean, you know. But I felt like I had to document that. So I did kind of take some shots that way, and took some had some friends over this last Saturday, and we took some Polaroids for a little party here in the little pre-birthday gaming party in the cave here. So that's about all I've done as far as photography. But a little bit bummed about this Pentax digital SLR situation, because I thought, you know, I'd buy this and I don't have to buy another digital camera for probably a decade. By then, they'll have like a microchip they put in your eyeballs, and then you'll just take photos that way. And
you wink at people. Yep. You're all set.
Yep. Well, actually, I think the vaccine actually had some sort of digital camera inside of it. So.
Yeah, that's the 5G.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So, all right. Well, that's pretty much what we've been up to. We're going to go ahead and take us a little break here. We have a ton of great questions to Jeff and Gabe from the Negative Positives Film Photo Podcast Facebook group. So we're going to get to that in the next segment. So we'll take a break and be right back, folks. All right, folks, we are back from the break, and in this segment, of course, as usual, we go to the fine folks of the Negative Positives Film Photo Podcast Facebook group to ask our fine guests some deep probing questions. We're gonna probe them deep here, so we'll start off with Andre. You going first?
Sure.
All right.
So first up, from the Great White North, Mr. Peter Planta says, how often does your photography influence your writing? Do you ever write scenes with specific frames in mind and hope that the director is able to translate it one-to-one?
You first, Gabe.
Well, I will tell you this, that I will often try and put a camera on a character as many times as I can. One particular one is a show called Life as We Know It that we shot in Vancouver. And Chris Lowell, who is an actor, for his first gig ever, I put an old Leica M4 and told him, I want you to shoot with it. So I kept giving him film, and he knew nothing about photography. And he started shooting, shooting and shooting. And cut to 16 years later, and he's a huge photographer. And he has, you know, he did a show with Dave LaChapelle and stuff like that. But I'm always trying to put cameras on characters, and I think that definitely framing and types of shots you're always trying to write in, and luckily in television we are showrunners, so we can nicely suggest it would be so great if you could get that shot.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
There's a term we use in screenwriting, directing on the page.
Yeah.
You know, being really explicit about visual design. It's something we did a lot on Desperate Housewives. We would be really, really specific, even about what camera move we envisioned and what sort of framing we envisioned. And it's something you think about also for comedy. I mean, think about, you know, foreground, background stuff in comedy is such a thing. Like two characters. There was a Friends episode we did, the Blackout episode, where Phoebe is playing Top of the World in the foreground. And in the background, Ross is being attacked by a feral cat. You know, you think about these sort of things when writing. And so it's always in there. You know, I think Gabe and I both come from sort of filmmaking disciplines, And no matter what kind of TV you're making, you are always trying to think visually. Even though dialogue is in the foreground, you are trying to think about shot design as much as you can.
Definitely.
And so, Gabe, for you, like when you are putting something in there that is extremely specific, such as a specific kind of camera, like how does that actually come into the fold on set? Is that like your own personal camera from your extensive collection that you are like, hey, I'm gonna put this around your neck, you're gonna wear this, kid? Or, you know,
it depends. Sometimes that if it's something I don't have, then props will do it. But a lot of times I will just take a camera and let the actor use it, you know, throughout the shoot, because I want them to know the camera. But it really depends. There have been times where, like in Diary of a Wimpy Kid, the first movie, there's this flashback of our lead kid, and he's in a boxing ring, and there's all these flash bulbs, like, you know, crazy old timey flash bulbs. And that was like, I had the most fun on set ever. Like, it was just absolutely, wow. They had all those flash guns and just tons of people were operating them. And so we really had that feeling of old time flash bulbs or, you know, newsreel kind of thing. It was really cool.
Nice. So what's your guys' stances on laugh tracks? It's very,
I mean, if they're real, I mean, you know, I worked on both Friends and Will and Grace. Those were all authentic laughs uttered by genuine people in a real room.
Okay.
So I think laugh tracks are great. I think I think for younger viewers these days, Andre, I'd love for you to chime in on this. I think that shows I don't love the term laugh track because it implies artifice, but shows that have a live audience laughing, that feels kind of antique. Mm-hmm. And those shows can tend to feel dated now.
Right, right.
But, God, give me an old episode of Cheers or an old episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show or even an old episode of Friends. It gives a sense of life and, you know, a theatrical experience that I think is invaluable.
I didn't even notice the laugh track on Friends. I love that show. And I have a coworker that doesn't like it for that reason. Yeah, thank you. And I don't even notice the laugh track because I just laugh on my own. So I don't know. It's not a problem for me. I think it is for some people, but they're thinking too much about it.
I think it's just some of them are just so bad. It's just the bad ones. I think you really know. And once you notice it, you can't stop concentrating on it. You know, like it's like, yeah.
I think means the show is bad.
Yeah.
If the show is bad, you're going to notice it. It's going to bother you. But if you actually are laughing, then you don't even notice it.
So I'm going to put out a physical challenge right now. Let's all laugh like a laugh track. Like, everybody ready?
You got to count down.
3, 2, 1.
Well done. Well done.
Great. I hope you save that little piece and then copy and paste it onto lots of different things.
Have one editing that, Mike.
I'm definitely going to save that, and we should totally have a show where we have a laugh track the entire time.
Exactly. Just triple it.
The ironic thing is that really shitty laugh track actually made me laugh. But speaking, you know, as somebody from the younger generation, like the thing that stands out the most clearly to me, like recently, was something like WandaVision, where there are different episodes that are trying to emulate certain eras of TV. And so I don't even necessarily think that it feels dated, because I think that has a really like negative connotation to it. Like there's simple little things about, you know, the framing, the presence or lack thereof of a laugh track that instantly can transport you into something. The same way that I think that a lot of times, like the way that things are framed, you know, the wide shots live studio set are very different than what movies look like these days that are being shot out on location. And so I think that it's really, really interesting just seeing these things change over time. And I'm sure that the experience of using different cameras absolutely has an effect on what y'all do for work.
Definitely. Definitely.
Very cool. All right. Well, let's move on to our next question.
All right. Sherry Christensen asks,
oh boy,
if you had one camera and lens for the rest of your life, what would it be?
From the Embrace the Grain podcast, of course.
Gabe, did we cover this? I'm trying to remember. I probably changed my mind since we last talked about it.
My head hurts just thinking about that. If I could only have one camera and one lens for the rest of my life. I would say this. It would be my Leica M6. And I would have to say the old version, 35 millimeter Summicron F2. I think if I just had one that I could rely on, then that would be it. I think that would be it.
I'm sorry.
Right, well,
I think you pronounced that a little wrong. Mike, do you want to correct him?
Yeah, that would be Leica.
Oh, yes. No. I'm sorry. Leica. Yes. I always forget that.
I have it right here. That would be the Alpa 11SI with the 50 millimeter Kern macro Switar lens.
That's rest of your life. Rest of your life.
Nope. Rest of my life. I know.
Jeff, you know, nobody, we did this. But it's interesting. Me and Gabe knows about this camera, so why don't you illuminate the audience?
The Alpa is a Swiss camera that was made in vanishingly small numbers by a company called Pignon, whose primary business was making watch gears.
Oh, good.
These are all hand-built. They're hard to come by. You'll never own one. I'm surprised I do. It's a beautiful camera that's very strange. It winds front to back instead of back to front, which is very weird. It's got a very strange rewind apparatus, which I love to talk about. Look at that. Look how weird that is.
Wow. And
this lens, this Kern lens, Kern is a company that also makes cinema lenses. This is one of the few lenses they ever made for 35 millimeter still cameras. And this is my favorite lens of all time. It's just, and it's a macro too. It's a 1.9 macro. So if I had to pick one camera, it would be this.
Wow. That's out of left field. Yeah.
Yep. Definitely left field. Alpha's a
Awesome. All right. So what we got next?
Next up, we have got Mr. Alex Morrison, who says, money is no object. Would you rather write or take photographs if you could only do one?
What?
Oh, man.
We're making it hard for you folks. You have to kill your darling.
What do you think?
When we say we're going to deep probe, we go deep.
You know, yes, we're feeling it.
You know, you're okay. I mean, writing is very hard. It's really, really hard.
Let's be honest. Exactly.
It's very, very hard. And at this point in my life, photography feels like a vacation from all that. Mm. You know, it's an ability to create without a lot of the anxiety and pain and grinding and rewriting and notes that are inevitably descend upon you, you know? So at this point, photography just sounds like a kick. So asking me on this particular day, if I had to choose one, it'd be taking pictures.
Well, there you go. There you go.
I see, you're on the exact same thing. The exact same thing.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. I mean, the process and the odds of getting a show on the air and how much work that takes, and then you're constantly being told how bad what you're doing is over and over again. And why can't you do it differently?
I feel like that's the case in some of the photo groups too, though. So
I'm sure. But yeah, I think I would love it. I would love to just shoot. That would be nice.
So have you guys ever been like behind the camera on a production, or is it just you have? Okay. And did you enjoy that a whole lot? I mean, do you like use any of your knowledge of still photography when you're behind an actual cinema camera or whatever? Like
I came from an art school background in college. I majored in filmmaking and choreography. And when I started writing for sitcoms like, you know, Friends and Will and Grace, those are much more like filmed theatrical productions. But I always wanted to get back to filmmaking. My first job was a single camera show on HBO called Dream On, which was shot more like a movie. And I always wanted to get back to making those kind of shows. And I always had in the back of my mind that directing was something I really wanted to do. And finally, about midway through my tenure on Desperate Housewives, I got to do it. And it was like a whole different set of muscles. Mm. It was so much fun to write things that I knew I was going to be able to shoot myself, where I wasn't going to hand them over to a director to execute. And when I was writing the script, I knew that whatever visual design I had in mind on the page, I would actually be able to realize, I would be able to work with a DP and work with a production designer, work with camera operators. So it was exhilarating, and it was enabled me to roll in my photographic experience into making shows. So it's fun. That's the adventure I'm on now. That's relatively recently. That's just the past like 8 or 9 years that I've been directing, which has enabled me to access that. So it's really fun.
All right, cool.
You've had a thing, right?
Yeah, on this, I've directed before, but also on this last show we did for NBC called The Night Shift, which we shot in Albuquerque for 4 years. Directing that, it's the same thing. You get to, you know, experiment and sort of talk to the DP and try to get shots in that are different or sort of give a little bit of your signature on them. So it's a lot of fun. It is exhausting, but it is a lot of fun.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. So where are we at? Jess, you got the next question, is that it?
Yeah. So John Michael
Mendieza.
Mendieza.
Who just recently, he just recently did an episode himself on the Sunny 16 Presents feed. You guys check it out.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. What gives you more of a thrill, taking pictures or seeing the results? And also, what is your least favorite thing about film photography and why?
I love this question.
It's so good.
Film is not sunshine. There are shitty parts about it.
Well, my least favorite thing about film photography is me. That's my problem, because I have I'm doubting myself the entire time. So I think that that's one of the things that, you know, in digital you're like, oh, I'll get the shot. I mean, I'll probably get something, but in film I'm so like nervous that something's gonna go wrong. And I would say probably if I really broke it down, it would be processing it. I think that would be sort of my issue is just wanting to get it right. But I love shooting, but I think definitely seeing the results is amazing. It's very exciting to me.
Do you home process?
Can help you with that whole processing thing. There's maybe a company that makes some cool stuff that makes that stuff.
Well, I just want you to know that I just got the Monobath and I just couldn't believe it. But this was Jeff telling me, because I start explaining my process, my neurotic process of development. He goes, you know, they have Monobath. I go, no, that's impossible. How could that ever be? That's been very exciting. Like just to sort of get into it. But yeah, I do both. So Mike, when it's something critical, in my head, or it's an actor that, you know, I really want to make sure they come out right, I will probably send to the dark room. Mm. And then, or I'll do half and half. I'll send half to them and process some on my own.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Jeff, what's your thoughts?
Scanning color negatives, I think, is really hard. I've yet to come up with a satisfactory way to take a scanned color negative and convert it into a positive that looks right. And it feels like there's a lot of finesse involved that I don't really understand because I'm a Photoshop expert. So that's the part I like the least. And what was the other half of the question, Jess? I forget. You had a front half to the question.
It was really interesting. Well, what gives you more of a thrill, taking the pictures or seeing the results? And then what's your least favorite thing?
This is going to sound crazy, but taking the pictures is more of a thrill for me, because for me, photography is a way to focus. And it also is a means to adventure and exploration. You know, there are places that I would go in Los Angeles, and I have a camera over my shoulder as a pretext to go to these places. But the truth, you know, because otherwise I wouldn't go. Why would I go? But it gives me a reason to be adventurous, to go places, to see things, to slow down, to be aware of my surroundings. And I think that to me is more valuable in a lot of ways than the result. It's great if I come away with some images I like, but the experience of shooting and the experience of being in those spaces and, you know, interacting with people, cameras are great ways for me. I'm very introverted. And so it's a great way to sort of unlock me and enable me to interact with folks. So it's a means to being more adventurous than I actually am.
I kind of agree. I think I enjoy the actual taking more than the results sometimes, because sometimes the results are quite bad and then they ruin the beautiful experience I had out shooting.
Yeah. I can see that. Yeah.
So yeah, you get excited, man. It's like, oh man, that was a really good day out shooting. And then you develop it and you scan it and you're like, oh, well, that wasn't right. What else?
So, Jeff, I'm curious what your process is for developing color that's made you not enjoy it. Because I mean, I feel like for me, it's easier than black and white sometimes. It's just
the processing
great.
Itself, Cinestel C41. I'm a Cinestel guy through and through. Cinestel C41 is great. It's once I have the negative. And by the way, the Camerodactyl Mongoose, which I acquired several weeks ago, has made the speed of scanning much easier. So it really comes down to when I have those 36 shots that are color negative and I need to convert them to a positive, that's the laborious part. Because whether you're using Negative Lab Pro or Grain to Pixel or any of these other software packages that are designed to facilitate it, I always feel that there is something not entirely authentic. You know, there's judgment involved. You know, if it's I don't know why Portra 400 looks exactly like Fuji Superia 400 when if I printed those negatives, they would look very different.
Interesting.
So, I feel like we're still sort of playing catch up with these software packages in terms of making sure that film stocks look how they actually look.
Yeah. I mean, really, if you think about it, it's kind of all that like digital scanning or digital camera scanning or whatever. I mean, it's been around a bit, but it's kind of in its infancy. I mean, we're still really, you know, so.
Yeah.
Do you shoot any medium format?
Some. I mean, when I shoot medium format, I mainly 120. I have a Pentax 6x7. I have a Rolleiflex. When I shoot medium format, it's funny because I have a lab box that will process them, but I've just never processed it. I've never processed it myself. I always send that out. And it's delightful. Yeah, it's delightful. But I don't shoot as much medium format as I should.
I
think you might be more satisfied if you did that one yourself and you kind of see those differences a little better. I've just 35 is just so small. I don't know. It's just, when you see six by seven and you do that in Negative Lab Pro or whatever you use, and it's just, it looks so good. It's very satisfying.
I'm going to try that.
You should try it.
Teach you how to use that 120 module on the lab box. We can have a little private lesson once we're all next.
Yes, please.
I need that too. Yeah.
Well, 35 millimeter is small, as Jess said during the break. Andre has a small strap on. I mean, if you can see the video, he does. He has it's a camera strap, folks. I don't know. You all
what
need
are
to
you thinking? Right.
He has a small strap on his shoulder.
Right.
You don't know what? Judge here on negative positives.
You can't say anything on this podcast without somebody taking it wrong. I don't understand what's going on around here, but
flesh tones. Jeff was talking about the color of his skin earlier, and my first thought was the flesh tones of his skin, Mike.
Yeah, well, you know, flesh tones are important. All right. All right, where are we at? We should move on as we went off the rails there.
Let's see. Next up, we've got Negative Positives Facebook group moderator and host of the Soot and Whitewash podcast, Mr. Neil Piper, saying here, Jeff and Gabe, absolutely love the show, and I'd like to know this. Both you guys, what is both of you guys' most hated camera? A camera that I couldn't even pay you to use.
Okay.
Gabe, go for it. I got to think about this.
Companies are defunct. You're not going to be burning any bridges.
No, okay. I think the Argus Brick would be a camera that you couldn't pay me to use. I have lifted them up at camera shows before and put them right back down. And it also seems way too complicated to take a picture. So, that's one that would be it.
Yeah, that's a good one. I was going to say the Univex Mercury 2. Anybody use that thing?
No.
I don't think
I've even seen that one.
A Univex Mercury 2 has a lot of things that you'd think I would like. It's a half-frame camera, and it has a rotary shutter. But I just encourage anyone who has not seen one of these. I owned one very briefly very briefly. And I ended up returning it to the shop that I bought it from. It is just ungainly, ugly, weird, strange, inaccurate. So, yeah. But Gabe is right. The Argus. I've never understood the popularity of the Argus.
I had an Argus brick. And of course, I got it for like, I don't know, $8, something like that. And I did take one roll of film with it. I did sell it. So maybe I'm not justifying it all that well. But and I got good results out of it. And I think the thing about that camera is, I mean, it really did. I mean, from a historical standpoint, it kind of solidified 35 millimeter photography in America. So you got to give it at least, it made that accessible for the working, sure. for the working man in America. So, but the thing I will say I hated about it, the tiny, rangefinder window was
real rough.
Yeah. But, and of course the one I had, it was real yellowed and kind of cloudy. So it just made it, kind of
what a pleasure real to use.
But I would. There's part of me that still wants to get another one to try again because the nice thing about those cameras is like they literally never die. Like they're indestructible. And like if something does go wrong, anyone can fix them. Like it's just a matter of. I think there's like I don't know. It's like, I think it's just like a spring and like I think there's like a couple of ants in there that move things. So I don't know. But, so just put a couple of new live ants in there.
Right.
All right. So what do we got next?
All right. We've got Vicky and Bill Thu.
Bill Thu.
I get the impression you both spend every free second of the day thinking about cameras and photography, and I feel validated.
Great.
Can you see yourselves ever turning professional, I guess in the film sense, or is it better to keep it an amateur's love affair? Supplementary question. Have you ever used film for making any of your shows? Great show, guys.
Oh, okay.
I can cross that one off my list. That was one question I was going to ask you about the film use. So,
well, let me field the second one first. That's a great question. Until Desperate Housewives, every show I worked on was shot on film.
Nice.
Typically was you would shoot the film and then you would immediately transfer it to digital for editing purposes.
Right.
It was something we refer to as film look. A lot of those shows like Friends, Frasier, Cheers, these were all shows that were shot on film and typically edited on, in the case of Cheers, very primitive digital editing systems. But by the time it got to Friends, it was like the Avid, you know, like really good high-end editing systems. Desperate Housewives started out shot on film. And we had an amazing director of photography named Lowell Peterson, who I worked with when directing most of my episodes of that show. During the, I think it was eighth season of the show, Jess just got giant again. midway through the seventh season of Desperate Housewives, the decision was made to
transition.
Start shooting digital instead. Transition. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. The decision was made. I've had half a scotch. The decision was made to transition to shooting digitally. And our DP had not worked with high-end digital cameras. So I believe it was the Red Scarlet was the camera that we used. And we had representatives from Red come to the show and walk us through the different LUTs. You know what a LUT is? A lookup table. It's the digital equivalent of a film stock. And I got to learn with the DP about this transition. As a matter of fact, in a Halloween episode of Desperate Housewives that I directed, the very first piece of digital cinema in the history of Desperate Housewives was a fake movie on television, a Halloween-like thriller that we shot digitally and dropped into my episode. So I had the honor of shooting digital cinema on Desperate Housewives. But then for the last year and a half of the show, it was digital. So it was very interesting to see the Panavision mags, which were full of, you know, huge amounts of film, replaced with equivalent looking mags that were filled with compact flashcards.
Plus, there were mini dark rooms on every set. So when we did Freaks and Geeks, we shot that on film, and then Undeclared shot on film. And then what would happen is, as we started doing our own shows, the studio would say, they would immediately say you're shooting on digital, and then you'd have a fight, and then you'd be able to shoot on film. And then the following year, especially when we were at Sony, it was like you're shooting on digital and you would, they would send you a tape and say, look, you can't even tell the difference. You could tell every time. You could literally say, this is Sony, this is film, this is Sony, this is the film. And that started getting more and more. But sort of now, you unless you're a really pretty much big director, like I'm very close with Judd Apatow, and Judd is able to shoot film when he wants to shoot film. Awesome. And I am not. So I am, you know, when we're shooting a show, it's going to be, it's going to be on digital.
Yeah. It was interesting, just real quick. You know, one of the things that I found fascinating about the transition from film to digital is that with film, you are always worried about underexposing. You're always worried about shadow detail, right?
Right.
Digital, you are always worried about overexposing. And so it completely changes your lighting strategies because you need to make sure that things don't get blown out because there's no way to recover that detail.
Right.
So it inverts, in a way, the director of photography's job in terms of what you're trying to protect against.
And you need a lot less lighting. So the funniest thing is on Night Shift, which is a hospital show that we built, you know, two huge hospitals on two soundstage. And you just, there's all the stands, like hundreds of C-stands and all the lights and on and on. They'll never get used. They'll never get used. They just don't use them anymore. So it's much more natural lighting. It's just a different beast now. So it's very interesting to see the transition.
So there's no such thing as like a mix on a show, is there? Because
film and digital?
Yeah.
Not now. I mean, I'm sure some people, like if you're doing a flashback, maybe they'll let you shoot something fun on 16 or just to, you know, to do it. But it's mostly all digital and then they'll treat it in post.
Right.
Unacceptable. Unacceptable.
I just want to make sure we handled everything Bill asked. Was there something else? There was a front half of the question, wasn't there?
Sorry. Oh, could you see yourselves turning professional, I guess, in film? But you said you worked with film before in shooting shows. That was like, professional, basically.
Yeah, but I think he's talking about becoming professional photographers. Gabe has gotten closer to that than I have, actually.
I don't know. I mean, I've done a bunch of gigs.
What constitutes a professional?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I've done a lot of professional gigs. I did a couple magazines last year that I donated whatever the payment was going to be. And it was just so exciting to go do it. So it was, I loved it. I don't know if I would ever be hired again, but no, I'm kidding. It was great. I did a few jobs like that and I loved it. It was really enjoyable, but you know, the day job always interferes with going any further. Yeah.
I remember my dad came and visited me at this, the big art show I do. He'll come out and visit me and you know, I'm selling like, you know, prints or whatever for like $20. It's not big money or anything. It's an outside art show. And, I remember one time I turned to my dad, I was like, you know, I've made a couple $100 a day. I guess that means someone's paying for my photography. That means, I'm a professional photographer.
So good.
But all right, so what do we got next?
All right, coming from New Zealand, Mr. Theo Panagopoulos asks, what's your next purchase and why that camera?
Gabe, do you have a next purchase lined up?
Do you mean things coming in the mail, or do you mean what exactly you're talking about? Well, okay, so my next purchase that just happened was, again, look through some photography sites, saw this great, these great portraits with a 50 F4 on the Pentax 6.7. And that's something I don't have. I just have the 105 2.4. And I am very excited to get that. And then, of course, I saw another portrait and just got the Minolta XE7. I just had to look down and purchase that. But you know, the one I would love to get, I think, is really, I've been advised 100 times not to, is the Rolleiflex SL66.
Oh, I've just been shooting with that.
Oh my gosh, we have to talk about it because Every repair person says, don't be an idiot. Don't get it. It's going to die, and then you can't get it fixed.
Oh, no.
Have you tried one, Gabe?
I've only tried one once a long time ago, and I loved it.
So the twins, so Brandon and Brian Wright, the co-founders of Cinecillin and my boss, have one. And I've been shooting one for about a month now and playing around with it. If we meet up, you know, I'd be more than happy to.
That'd be so fun.
Now, it's great. It does in terms of the repair situation, but it's awesome. Right. I've taken one of my best night photos on 800T with it, with the front tilt feature. It was the back tilt feature of the lens of this tattoo shop in LA with the neon lighting, just completely obliterating the bottom port of the bottom portion of the frame with that 80 f2 planar. Like,
so chef, cool.
Like, just we'll talk, Gabe.
We'll get together. Yeah.
Was this a Roly? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. So for folks that may not know, the SL66 was the camera that Rolleiflex came out with. I can't remember. I think it was 1966 at Photokina, after the gentleman's agreement between Victor Hasselblad and was it Friedrich Heidecke or something like that?
Hasselhoff.
After their gentleman's agreement dissolved between the two of them, that one wouldn't make a TLR and one wouldn't make an SLR. And it looks like a Hasselblad in sort of overall form and function, but it's got a focal plane shutter, retro mounting able lenses, a bellows focusing system, and one of the most unique things about it is a kind of tilt shift feature with a scale on the side for Scheimpflug calculations.
Ooh, cool. Oh, no.
It's like 6x6 large format handheld. It's amazing. But as Gabe mentioned, like, there are almost no parts for it. So it's one of those few mechanical cameras that, like, when people are like, oh, buy a mechanical because you can get it fixed, it's like, there are things you can get fixed and there are things that you cannot easily get fixed. Nothing is impossible, but, you know, custom CNC machining of things and 3D printing certain parts, and that gets pretty damn expensive.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff, what did you have? What's coming in the mail?
Nothing. I'm in a moment of absolute zen serenity right now. There's nothing I want.
Nothing.
I'm telling you, it won't last, but right now, I'm so happy with what I've got. I mean, as I said, these two cameras, the Widelux and the Rolleiflex SL350, are what I'm shooting with the most, and I'm enjoying that. So those are relatively recent acquisitions. So I'm kind of shooting the heck out of those right now, and I'm content. Trying to enjoy that feeling.
Wow. Now we know that that Jeff is drunk on whiskey. We can go on to the next
thing. Exactly. We've cleared that up. We can move on.
Scotch.
And I'm out of bourbon, right?
That's right. This is Horse Soldier Bourbon.
Nice.
That's why he's content.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
There you go.
It better be Kentucky bourbon, because if it's calling itself bourbon, it ain't from Kentucky.
I believe it is Kentucky bourbon.
Good, good. Nice. Then we're solid. We're straight. But I didn't want to have to kick you off the podcast. So, yeah. All right. What we got next?
All right. Pierre asks, I hope that we will also get a detailed account of the team leader training.
Mike.
Yeah, Mike, you didn't talk about that part in your
God, my goodness. I had to do 3 days of day shift, and I haven't been up that early. I had to get up at 4 a.m. for 3 straight days for 10-hour training, 30 straight hours of death by PowerPoint, man. And it was it's like, seriously, I would rather be in the worst job on the factory floor than go through that again. Like, I literally wanted to, like, I don't know. Like, if there would have been like a rafter, I probably would have hung myself at some point. Like, it was awful, man. And, but I made it through. So, I am officially trained, and, hopefully there was this, you know, every time you take one of these classes, you always have the person to ask a ton of questions. And I'm like, every time that person would ask questions, I'd be like, like glaring.
You're slowing it down.
Like,
you want to get out of school, the one person.
Yeah. You could have got it like an hour or two earlier if they would just stop asking questions, you know. And So at one point, though, she says, you know what? I really have enjoyed this class. And I really think that we should probably get refreshed on this at least yearly. And I was like,
no, no. No, see, we will not.
Mike, what you have is natural leadership. And so you don't need to be trained on this stuff. Just tell the higher ups at Ford that and you'll be all good.
Right.
Like,
right.
You don't like you guys don't know. I lead the Negative Positives podcast. It's kind of a big
right. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that will not work, but I appreciate the sentiment, Andre. But all right, let's move on.
All right. The next question though, Malcolm Myers asks, how adventurous are you in your film/developer combinations, or are you more vanilla, sticking to tried and trusted? If you are adventurous, do you have specific combinations for particular cameras or subjects?
Oh my God, I'm so vanilla. I mean, I've talked about this on the podcast. For me, it's all about my CineStill C41 kit and my CineStill DF96 monobath, and that is all I am using. Wow. I'm not really interested in an adventure right now. How about that?
And so with that check from Andre is coming when? Well, actually, Andre hasn't even sent out the prizes for the Ghost Challenge photos yet. So I'm pretty sure your check's going to take a while to get there. So
just to compliment Andre's employer for a minute. They work like clockwork. I mean, DF96 is great. It's so easy to use. It's so convenient. It's, you know, developer and fixer all in one combo. It's self-terminating, so I don't worry so much. And then the C41 kit is the first C41 kit I've ever used, the first time I've ever processed color film. I had been so intimidated by processing color, and it's a three-bath scenario. And I have a sous vide stick that I use to help stabilize temperature, but it's a piece of cake. It's so easy. We were talking about this in our last episode.
It's very easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Gabe, did you answer that one?
I am as vanilla as could be. I mean, even when I was experimenting, it was, you know, what's the easiest thing I can do that I will get an image? I'll be very happy. I started with HC110. And then just recently, you know, been introduced to the monobath. I just picked it up. So I'm very excited and to start using it. And you know, color terrifies me. So I can't tell you anything about color yet, but Jess seems excited about it. So I feel like I have to try it. And especially a large format. I would love to try that. I just think that'd be great. But
Gabe,
it's so easy.
Gabe, in short order, we're going to have you developing some large format slide film in like high dynamic range CineStill dynamic.
So excited.
Yeah, I want
to go as far as you can go to the top.
I can't wait. I'm ready.
I have to wonder if you guys are, you know, a little adverse to risk in your film photography developing. Is it because you're so used to working on these, you know, expensive TV productions and you don't want to screw up because there's a lot of money at stake? I'm just throwing that theory out there. I don't know.
No, it's like, I mean, look, you're responsible for a lot of money, but it's not like you see this money ever. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, it's literally, you know, you do a series and you're responsible for $50 million a year. And but you are responsible for it. You do take it seriously, but you're not looking at piles of cash that you're freaking out about every 5 seconds. But I just think it's the unknown. I wish I was freer with experimenting for that kind of stuff. Like, I love when photographers will go out and just try crazy stuff and get really cool images. Like, that's what I strive to do. I love that idea.
Once you do color, you're going to be like, black and white is a thing of the past.
Oh, I can't wait.
Outside of the black and white monobath, color is just so much easier. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. See, that's, I can't even understand that. To me, I thought, do you need to know math? Do you need to, you know, do all these calculations to do color?
No. Before, I didn't even used to have a sous vide, and I would just heat up the water in my sink and let the bottles heat up in there. At the moment, I have a different kind of sink, so I got a sous vide off of Facebook Marketplace for like $20. And so I use it now just because of the type of sink that I have, but you otherwise don't even need that. It's just such a piece of cake. And I know that Jeff has said he has trouble kind of scanning stuff in, but I really think with the right tweaks, you can get into a very easy workflow that's not complicated. Because I hardly ever edit much color or anything in my photos. It's like kind of a white balance, and that's all I need, and that's it. I really think that once you get that workflow down, you're going to just absolutely fall in love with color developing.
Perfect. I remember the first kit I bought of color, I did the just warming up the chemicals in the sink, you know. And I remember Andre was on the show. It's one of his early appearances on the show, and he mentioned this thing called a sous vide, and I had no idea what he was talking about. And I was like, what is this? What is this foreign language this kid's bringing up? And and I just kind of just glossed over it. I didn't probe him on it. And and then he mentioned it again, like another time. I was like, all right, I'm going to have to ask him what this thing is, because I have no idea what he's talking about. He's just going to keep bringing it up. So, but the sous vide does make it a lot easier. So,
it does.
All right. So, what we got next?
Next up, from Mr. Billy Sanford asks, this question gets asked of many people, but particularly people with a lot of camera knowledge. What is your recommendation for a complete novice?
Oh, interesting.
Well, I this is what I can say, and it's all because of Jeff. I recently, I was going to say had one, but I got into the Olympus OM-1 in a very strange set of circumstances where I kept ordering them and one was broken and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it is so comfortable and easy to use. And I had never used an Olympus OM-1 in my life. And to me, with that metering system and a simple 50, I think that is a great starter camera, and they're not expensive and you can find them.
That was my first 35 millimeter. It is a great camera.
I mean,
it's hard to argue with that. If I was going to just pick a slightly different direction, I think if you're an absolute novice who doesn't even really want to learn the exposure triangle, you just want to shoot film and see good results, I would get an Olympus XA4 because you can basically treat that as a point and shoot. It is pocketable. You can have it with you all the time. And it's got a great glass lens. They are not overpriced yet. A lot of the Olympus XAs are climbing in price, but the XA4, which is extraordinary and has a macro lens, is so easy to use. I mentioned this on the podcast the other day. The XA4 is the camera I shot with the most in calendar year 2020. It's just so easy to like stick in your pocket and take anywhere. But yeah, for the novice who wants to learn, the OM-1 is absolutely ideal and so cheap.
I'm actually going to go a slightly different direction if I can kind of pop in here a little bit. The Nikon FE, relying on a battery in order to power both the meter and the shutter, it is the camera that I learned photography on. And as much as I appreciate and respect Jeff's opinion in terms of just having something in your pocket and having fun, the ability to see in the viewfinder with that match needle system, feeds on the left-hand side, and where the meter says that you should be according to where you're placing that center 40-60 metering pattern, and also where your shutter speed is actually set, so that you then start learning the relationship between where you're placing that circle in terms of your metering, what the camera thinks that you should be doing, and making intentional decisions on, you know, over and under exposure. That is the camera that taught me photography. Wow. And that's what I recommend.
It's great. Great camera.
The reason why
that's a great pick.
Kind of destroying mine is because I'm converting it into a press pan, because I had so much fun using one.
Wow.
Playing around with my Kukavikas and watching Jess Hobbs' video, that I will be destroying that camera and creating a monster, a beautiful panoramic, all mechanical monster.
Wow.
Nice. Well, I'm just going to say, just get Pentax. That's what you want to do. So
there
that's
you go. just a preview. We were asked to help Graham replace a camera he was giving away as a prize on the Cheap Shots Challenge on Sunny 16. And one of the cameras we recommended was the Pentax ME Super, which
that's to a me good is one.
still undervalued, like just a phenomenal camera that, you know, K1000s are skyrocketing in price, but for some reason the ME has stayed fairly inexpensive and it's just great and tiny.
And they're very tiny. My experience with the ME Super is they are a little more prone to failure now. They're just at the point where I think the electronics has kind of, they've had their service life is kind of getting there, but but the weird thing is the ME, which is a little less, a little more basic than the ME Super, it's that you can't go all mechanical, you can't go all manual with the ME. It's only like an aperture priority camera. But MEs always seem to work. ME Supers, it's sometimes it's difficult to find one that functions properly. But man, when you do get a good one, the ME Super is a great camera. And all right, I think we got that one done. Are we getting through these? We're 48 minutes into the segment, and where are we at?
We're about halfway. We're a little more than halfway through.
All right,
let's go through a lightning round.
Lightning round.
I'm gonna go to the restroom real quick, so I'm gonna let Andre take this next.
Okay. Turn. Okay. Did you have oysters today, Jess?
I wish. I love oysters. I had this huge can of beer and then another beer before that, so I gotta go. I gotta go to the bathroom. I don't know what y'all are doing.
That's why you gotta keep like a big gulp cup right here next to your desk.
Mike. Andy, we've got another quick one here from we've actually got a few from Pierre Alex Favillier. Hope I pronounced that right. So we're just gonna do this lightning round. So
okay.
Got one that says, I hope that we will also... No, wait, my bad. Question for J&G. Are they ever going to spin out of Sunny 16 and go solo?
Not a chance.
We love them.
keep Graham
Sunny
working.
Sunny 16's aspect of it is a really interesting concept. And I'm loving you guys there. So,
it's fun. We like those guys.
Yeah, it's great. Fun.
Next up, from Mr. Sam Warner, COVID has kept many of us from traveling, thus limiting where we've been able to shoot. Where is the place that you just can't wait to shoot once traveling restrictions are lifted? Jeff, go.
London.
Gabe, go.
New York.
Mr. Robert Lanez, hello, fellow Angelinos. Is there a camera that your podcast co-host owns that you wish you owned?
Oh.
This is a good one.
Yeah, Gabe, you go first.
I'll go. I definitely think that Alpa, that lens is so legendary that I would love to try that lens. That's one of those cameras that I did have an Alpa for 12 hours once, and it didn't have that fancy lens. But yeah, I think I would love that Alpa with that lens. It's very cool.
Gabe has a lens I want. I need a 35 millimeter Summicron because the Summa Lux that I have is way too heavy. And so I'm kind of coveting his 35 millimeter Summicron. And of course he has this beautiful black paint Leica M4 that is just the most lovely device. So maybe that one.
Awesome. All right. So we're up to Mr. Richard Moore. Jess, if you want to hop in and read that one.
Holy moly.
Yeah, we're lightning round now. Lightning round.
Yeah. Would you ever consider moving from LA to Kentucky?
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
As long as I can live in Mike's basement.
I don't have a basement. I can put you up here in the garage.
I've been to Louisville, and it's a great city. I actually love it. So I visited Louisville on a cross-country trip. I have friends from there. 100%. Yeah, beautiful, no question. Place.
Yep. Awesome. Oh, thank you. Thank you for that.
Would you or have you ever had to wait for a courier so a partner doesn't find out you've bought yet another piece of gear?
I
guess maybe you and Andre might have had that problem recently.
I'm
all about the too soon.
Nobody gets a say in that. I get the question of another one. Do you need another one? It's like, yes, I do.
Right. Another one.
Don't they all just take pictures?
I've been fortunate to have romantic partners who supported my gear acquisition. So it's never been a problem.
Right.
Good.
Very good.
All right. David Ortega asks here, ask them if there's more envy over having the smallest lens or the biggest slash fastest lens. You mentioned your Sumalux problems. Jeff, does this matter?
I would really like to try an Octolux one of these days. I know it's a big old piece of glass and that it's a very specific lens for a very specific application, but that is something I'd like to try one of these days. Or maybe the Canon 0.95 Dream lens. That's another thing I've kind of always wanted to try.
A lens that's bigger than the camera it goes on.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about
you? I mean, I love the old beat up, banged up Noctilux that I have that I got 20 years ago. But there's something about that, you know, the small, you know, having a Leica, I guess. Nice. and having it be as compact as possible. I mean, I love the idea of something compact. So,
yeah.
I mean, other than price, that's what keeps me from buying modern Leica lenses is that they've gotten bloated. I love that.
Ridiculous. It's crazy. Yeah,
collapsible lenses and teeny tiny pancake 35s.
Yep.
But yes, if I could afford one of these fancy spherical Summicrons and Sumaluxes, I would definitely do that.
I think that strap-on that Andre has got a little stiffer when he said Leica in that voice.
Warning, soft.
All right, where are we at?
Perlis asks or says, the Leica MP/MA are a couple of the last great film cameras that we can buy new today. If you guys could create a brand new film camera or line of cameras, what would it be like?
I am not interested in creating a brand new line of film cameras. We briefly referenced this on a recent episode. I think that the cameras, the 35mm cameras that have already been built, are perfect. And what we really need is people who can keep them in good repair.
Right.
When I see these, you know, Kickstarters for some new 35mm SLR, it's like you're never going to beat the OM-1. You're never going to beat the Nikon FE. You know, these are phenomenal machines. And like the idea that you're going to build one on a bench somewhere, and just because it has a USB rechargeable battery, it's supposed to be better. It has an iPhone interface. Who needs any of that?
Right. Exactly.
The cameras we have are perfect.
Right.
Yeah, we just need the film, right?
Yeah, that's right.
What about you, Gabe?
This goes with my bag issue where I can't find the perfect bag. So it's like with the
I'm with you there.
Oh no, Jess, you don't want to go there. It's horrible. Like I just can't ever find the perfect bag.
You and I gotta talk about this.
Yeah, it's a little crazy. But I agree. I think that, you know, do I wish that I had something like an SL66 mixed with something, you know, sure, you think about those things, but I think it's not. I would not want to be inventing one, and I don't know if I would. I just love the history of these cameras, and I think that they're exciting to use. So I don't think I'd be inventing one.
Yeah, that is half the excitement. Is, you know, when you whip out that camera and someone says, "Oh God, how old is that?" and you say, "Oh, this is from the 1950s and the 1960s, 70s, and it still works today," and they're just so blown away that something so old seemingly could work today, because stuff that they make now is not going to last that long. So yeah, like it is pretty cool to have those cameras.
Like my Pentax DSLR.
Well, now I know what not to get, because I'm thinking of buying my first digital camera, so I won't get a Pentax digital camera.
I'm not even going to call it a Pentax. I'm going to call it a Ricoh, because they have Pentax now. So, and they've screwed it all up. But anyway.
Also, those cameras, the new cameras that come out, it's it's just one after the other. It's just right. one and on, like A7, A7II, yeah. A7III, A7IV. It just goes on, A7R, A7S, and you're just going, I just, you know, I'm happy with my my camera, and yeah. I just want to...
They lose value so quickly.
Oh, really quickly. It's crazy. Mm-hmm.
Okay, right. Where are we at? Are we getting close? We are coming up.
Yeah, we just have two more people.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Mike Germanson, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, says here, while walking and listening to I Dream of Cameras, Jeff mentions Widelux. Jeff Bridges' work has been mentioned recently. Then KH sends an ad about an ugly conditioned Widelux for half the going rate. While on a spring break trip, I slipped and dropped that F7
oh,
in the creek.
God.
Jeff and Gabe, have you had an accident with the camera?
Oh, boy.
I got to refer you to the episode that's coming out later this week. Every mishap. I mean, we describe dropping cameras, slamming them into buildings, having them stolen, leaving film in them while we're opening the back. We talk about every kind of disaster. So I would just refer you there, unless there's something specific Gabe cares to relive.
Okay, I'll just tell you the one. Okay, one of the few. So we were asked to bring back the television show 90210, and I always have my M6 with me, and I had the 35 millimeter spherical F2 on the camera. And I was called away as I'm changing, taking off the lens off the body. And, you know, we wear headsets all the time. So I get up, my headsets get caught on the director's chair. The lens goes flying in the air. The entire camera department turns around frozen. They just like... Everything happened in slow motion. Their mouths drop open. I mean, they're just going, you got to be kidding me. And it slowly spins in the air and lands. And all you hear is tink. And it landed on the back element. Okay. And yes, all the things, the nausea, all the feelings that I had were, you know, I get it. I, you know, the next day, bring it over the repair and had it checked out everywhere. And the repair person said to me, this will never happen in your lifetime ever again. And I go, why? It shattered on the edge, the back of it, the lens. Had absolutely no effect on every test that they did on the lens.
Wow.
Then when I was in New York, I brought to B&H, the guys there who do all the repairs. They put it on their bench. They said, there is absolutely nothing wrong with this lens, other than if you wanted to get it fixed, it would be $2,000 at lights. They said there is absolutely, they've done every test. So that's one of the disasters you'll hear about.
Wow. Yes. Nice. Well, hey, we call that teaser.
Teaser
in the business. Yeah, there you go.
That's right.
All right. So we're down to the last one, right? Is my calculations correct?
Yep.
All right. And? It is.
Matt Murray.
Yay, Matt Murray.
Love that
guy. Yeah, Matt Murray. Two questions for Jeff and Gabe. One, a genie appears and gifts you a mint condition model of every camera ever produced in a high temperature controlled warehouse. Wow. Would you be happy? Or would the fun disappear now that the thrill of the chase is gone? Two, I'm still triggered from Jeff's "is using a point and shoot real photography?" question. So what is your favorite point and shoot?
Okay. Gabe, what do you think about the
Okay, well, I would be
scenario.
Yes. To have every camera on and on, I would know that first of all, it would take me the rest of my life to shoot with them all. So I'd be so excited to go try all these cameras like every day. It would be a new adventure to me. I would not lose the drive or excitement to shoot any of that.
Who wants that chase? No one wants that chase.
I know. It's really crazy.
I'll take the warehouse. Yeah.
I'll take the warehouse. Yeah. I think that's it. And then,
I think everybody would.
I would say favorite point and shoot to me is very, very beat up Yashica T4 for what I get out of it. I really love it. I bought it I think for $40 like 15 years ago. And I love it. I have it on set. It's one of my faves. So that's my favorite point of shoot.
I've never used a T4 because they're $400 now.
Crazy.
So I'm going to stick with my Olympus XA4 macro. That's my favorite point and shoot. If you can call it a point and shoot, there you go.
Sure.
And Matt Murray from Matt Loves Cameras gets a little defensive about his compact cameras, his point and shoots. Did you guys make some reference? I don't remember hearing it.
Well, we had an episode a few weeks ago. Yeah, we had an episode a few weeks ago, which was entitled Fight Us.
Yes.
And it was just us expressing inflammatory opinions about photography. And I didn't say point and shoot wasn't real photography. I asked the question.
Yes.
Yeah. Is point and shoot real photography? And I think that was enough to trigger Matt. So
yes,
I apologize if that seemed to mean it.
Okay, I do remember that episode now, and I think actually when you all brought that up, I think Matt Murray was the first person that came to my mind when you guys. All right, well, so we finally finished the questions, right?
All right. Yep.
Woo-hoo, all right. Yeah. Well,
thank you to the fine folks at the Negative Positives Film Photo Podcast Facebook group. Yeah, it really makes our job easier, and we're going to take us a much needed break. Jess already had a. Had a little break mid segment, but we're gonna take it. I gotta go water the thorny bush, and we need beverages and all that stuff. So we'll come back and wrap this show up. So we'll take a break and be right back, folks. All right, folks, we're back for the final segment, and this is where we the host like to, you know, get out their probes and really find out a little bit more about our special guests. So we're going to start off this segment with Andre. Andre, what do you got for Jeff and Gabe?
All right, folks. Well, Jabe.
I love it. Oh, my God.
We're it's one person now.
Jeff and Gabe have both had very illustrious careers in the City of Angels here in Los Angeles, Hollywood, California. A question that I really want to probe deeply to touch the emotional hearts behind these two wonderful gentlemen. What is more painful to you? The announcement of the discontinuation of a film or the canceling of a show that you are working on? And I'm saying this, like, I mean, I'm sure that it's happened to both of you, but like Freaks and Geeks was so special to me. And
okay, now imagine what it was to me. I'm sure it was very special to you.
It was to a lot of us. I loved Freaks and Geeks.
Well, I'll tell you, I would definitely say the TV thing, and I think that happened early enough in our careers that we're glad it happened then, because it was really painful when it ended. But it was a show that they some people in the network love, but the head person did not and did not get it. So there would be things like there were questions like, when is the geek making out with the cheerleader? And we would say that was not our experience. Our experience was sitting next to a girl, our knees touched by accident. And you're going, what did that mean? Oh, my gosh, my knee just touched that girl. Oh, my gosh. And it's one of those things that when you literally put all your life into it, I mean, everything single story in that show was from one of our lives. And we mixed our lives throughout the thing, but nothing was really made up. Not a lot of it was sort of. At least the sentiment was from something that really happened. And, you know, I never wanted to leave set. And I never saw my girlfriend at the time. I wanted to be there. So that is the biggest pain, I think, to me, was that kind of show. And after that, you know, nothing really felt the same. Like, it's like if a show got canceled, it'd be like, It wasn't Freaks and Geeks.
So like Freaks and Geeks is like the one thing, like you'll go to your grave proud of that, if nothing else, right? Like that's the thing.
Yes, because I feel like that was a very unique working experience. I think the fact that it was all our stories and that we worked with the actors in a different way and we just kept shooting and we just, the idea from, you know, Paul Feig, who created it, and Judd Apatow was, we are going to make a movie every week and no one's going to screw with it. We are just going to do it. And even if they don't like it, we're going to, don't break this family up. And the documentary is going to be out next year and it's like the most satisfying ending. I went back to the Tribeca Film Festival for it. And that after 20 years felt like, oh, I feel like, okay, I feel really
good. Was you involved in the documentary?
Well, I was involved because I, you know, they went to Paul and Judd, and Judd goes, go to Gabe's house. He saves everything. And so the guys, they're from Canada and they came over to the house and they saw my black and white stills. And I said, wait a minute, because I always had a little camcorder with me. And we opened one of my drawers and there were 45 hours of behind the scenes video, which was only for me. It was only to remember it because I had such a good time. There's no posting of that stuff. So they looked at me and said, thank you so much for making our documentary. So they took all that footage and transferred it. And then I also had, I'm sure if you saw earlier behind me, I have the mascot head from the show and I have the Parisian night suit and some other props and things like that from the show. But yeah, that was the most difficult. And I don't think I've had any other pain like that in professionally.
Wow.
Jeff?
Wow.
Well, Gabe, thank you for doing your part to create that. I mean, I discovered it way later in my life than it originally aired, but it had a huge impact on me as a nerdy kid who didn't fit in. So, you know,
love that.
Anything like that is a huge team effort, but like, thank you for doing your part to create that. Jeff, unfortunately, you know, it just so
never
happened.
Seen any of the things I worked on.
I've seen a lot of.
He's got fancy shows.
The Geeks did. I'm sorry. All right.
Well, I'll tell you one last thing is that, you know, it all comes from that heart from, you know, Paul Feig is growing up where he did and mixing him with Judd and the eight of us. It was just a really sort of magical time. It was very, very fun. Creatively.
Wow, very cool. Jeff, can you follow that up?
Well,
I think Andre kind of squashes the ego down a little bit.
No, it's fine. I mean, I'm going to talk about a small show that you've never heard of, and then I'll talk about the big shows. I, with my former writing partner, Jeff Strauss, there's a lot of Jeffs in these stories, created a show that ran on the Fox network for 1 year called Partners, which starred John Cryer, Tate Donovan, and Maria Patillo. And it was very much based on our own lives. And it was one of the first pilots we ever wrote. And it got picked up we made a great pilot. It got picked up to series. It ran for 1 year in 1995, 96. And I think I had a version of the experience that Gabe just described, something that was very personal and very intense. It was an enormous amount of work. It was an incredible group of people, artists all up and down the call sheet who came together to make something really beautiful that was underappreciated. And so it's not a show that anyone is going to make documentaries about, sadly. It's not even a show that's available on DVD or a streaming service. But for me, the demise of that show after one season, and one really good season, I know when I do good work, and I know when I do mediocre work, was a similar sort of heartbreak because it didn't really have to end. It was mishandled by the network that had it, Fox. And so it only went 1 year. So that was rough. In the other quadrants of my career, I've been really lucky to have lengthy experiences on shows where I left the party before the party ended. My first job, Dream On, I did for 5 years and I left before the show ended. I did the pilot and the first season of Friends. So I got to take a show from nowhere to number one, which was, I think, probably the most extraordinary year I'll ever have. And then during that year, wrote the pilot for Partners, which got picked up. So I never was around for the show being this massive titanic cultural force. I was around for when it was a scrappy little independent show that nobody cared about. Similarly, I came in very early on Will and Grace, stayed for 6 years, and got out before it ended. Desperate Housewives, same thing. Did 3 years on the show, left, did the first year of Parenthood, came back, did a few more years of Housewives, and left before it ended. So in every case, I was not around for the sad end of the party, and maybe it is because the experience on Partners inoculated me against ever wanting to have emotion.
Well, it sounds to me like, Jeff, once you leave a show, it just goes to shit. And obviously,
that's
it.
Every one of these experiences. No, I don't think that's the case. I do think that I am kind of a canary in the coal mine, though. And I think I do have a sense of when a show is starting to suck wind. And so I get out inevitable crash. But I've been so lucky in that I've had the opportunity to work on just shows that were culture defining, like three times over. Friends is still a phenomenon that people are talking about and care about, which is hilarious to me. There are in jokes in that show, characters that are named after people that I went to high school with, like things that I thought nobody would get but me. And so it was in some ways very similar to the experience Gabe had on Freaks and Geeks. It was an intensely personal show, but then it became this juggernaut. And the fact that people still care about it is remarkable to me. Will and Grace was a show that I think changed the conversation about gay characters in popular culture. And that was kind of amazing. I remember Joe Biden saying we made gay marriage possible, which was kind of incredible. And Desperate Housewives, though its star has faded a lot in recent years, was a show that I loved working on and learned a lot working on, loved the people. So I've been uncommonly lucky to have a couple of really great roller coaster rides with these shows. That said, nothing is harder than the demise of FP 3000B.
Thank you. That's true.
Nice.
Thank you.
Well, I think that gives us a great segue to go to Jess for the next question. So, because our pack film enthusiast on the show, so yeah. Jess, what do you have for the gang here?
So, I am a much bigger fanatic when it comes to TV shows than I am when it comes to movies. And I think TV shows have grown so much in these recent years than movies have. And I almost feel myself just not even wanting to watch a movie. I just want to watch shows that really pull me in. You know, you spend so much more time getting indulged in those characters. And so much so that you end up Googling them and seeing what they're doing in their regular lives. And I've seen in these past like 5 years or so many actors shooting film photography. I'll find their Instagram and I'll see them shooting film, and it's so cool to see that, especially in so many young people these days. And I was curious if you've seen that a lot yourselves. Just I guess not so much in this past year because it's been kind of different, but if it's something you've noticed and something that you've talked about with actors on these shows and something you've experienced personally, or if it's more of a disconnect. I'm not sure how much you interact with the people on set, or if you're more on the writing side. Yeah, a lot.
I know Jeff has stories as well, but we often will encourage film photography and, you know, give gifts of cameras. And I know Jeff has done
that's
that a bunch.
Awesome.
And I think it's, there's a lot of actors that do film photography and do it really well. I mean, just do really great work. Besides Crystal Lowell, I can think of Jennifer Beals. And Jennifer has shot stuff on set. And, you know, as a producer, an actor, or anyone on a set, you have a much different relationship with your actors than a set photographer does. So it's a much more personal relationship. Everyone's up for shooting, and you'll shoot in between takes, or, you know, when you guys are hanging out or anything like that. So, you know, I've seen some photography from actors is just amazing. And I love talking about it and love encouraging them to try it, because you just take your time. And that's something that, you know, you're moving. Everything's so crazy during a production that it's nice to know that you can take a film camera and go out and just focus on the one thing. And it's not 600 people telling you, or ask you a million questions or, yeah. and you have to make decisions on right away.
I feel like also when I see the work created by actors who are shooting on set, obviously they're their own people. They have their own autonomy. They're making their own decisions within the context of the direction of the show. But I imagine that that must be something so empowering for them to be able to frame the shots the way that they want within the context of how it's being framed and lit by the grips and the DPs and create yep. something that's not only a documentation of their own time on set, but the collaborative work of the entire, you know, set and cast. Like, that must be something really amazing. I've seen some like very negative Nancy, you know, perspectives with regards to the work that actors have done photographically on set and or otherwise, going down the rabbit hole of like, you know, oh, well, their photography is only being lauded because they're famous. But there is something to be said about the being in the right place at the right time, seeing the moments happening and benefiting from the collective work of everything that is being yep. done on set in order to light scenes and create moments that are iconic from a, you know, every frame is a painting kind of aspect. So I have a huge amount of respect for when actors are able to flex those creative muscles in a visual sense and create visual work like that in terms of behind the scenes stuff for on set photography. I don't subscribe to the fact that like, oh, it's, you know, they're just famous and their mediocre photos are being, you know, put on a pedestal because they're celebrities.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you, Andre. I think it's great. Jeff Bridges, I mean, we mentioned in passing his wide lux photography. That is extraordinary photography. Yep. And it isn't just because he's in the right place at the right time. He has a great feel for that camera and what it can do. And obviously he has this privileged vantage point as a guy who's in these amazing movies with these amazing people. But he also knows how to frame a shot. He's right. very adept with that camera. He's used it for 30 years. His books are amazing. Here's a different discipline. Andy Summers of The Police is yep. a phenomenal mm-hmm. film photographer, and his film books are great. I mean,
Michael Stipe from REM is also
yeah. Michael Stipe. Yeah. Seal mm-hmm. is a Leica photographer. You know, there's plenty of artists who have Lenny these Kravitz. Vantage yep. points. Lenny Kravitz, another good example. I was so excited. I direct a number of episodes of this CBS comedy called The Neighborhood with Cedric the Entertainer and Max Greenfield. It's a multi-camera half hour. And we'll talk about this in a minute, I think. But I was snapping away with my Olympus Pin EE half frame. And one day I showed up and Beth Bears, who is one of the leads of the show, brought her Lubitel to work. Her Lubitel.
Oh, wow.
Like, of all the cameras to choose, I was so delighted that she had this crappy Russian TLR. I mean, oh my God, it was so exciting. So I took some pictures of her taking pictures with that camera. And at the end of the week, I had just bought a box of cameras on eBay, and I gave her a Konica C35, 35 millimeter to shoot with. I find it really inspiring to see like young actors using film cameras and wanting to document what goes on around them. And Jeff Bridges to me is the best of the best of that kind of group.
Very cool. Yeah, I think this leads me. We're professionals tonight. It's kind of right into my segue for my question is, I think, Gabe, I feel like you maybe reached out to me really early on in this podcast. I don't know how long you've been listening, but it seems like it's quite a long time. Because I remember, I think you maybe hit me up on Instagram and I started following you. And I started looking through your photos. And like, it was like, I was at work. And so the next day when I got up, I told my wife, I was like, I have somebody that's listening to my podcast that has like photos of like the Freaks and Geeks actors and actresses. Like, how did this happen? Like, I think I finally made it in this world. But it makes me, and I kind of want to know from your guys' standpoint, people that, you know, love film photography, love shooting photography. Do you get, I mean, obviously, from seeing Gabe's photos early on, you had a chance, you had some time to take some actual film, you know, portraits of these actors and actresses on set. Like, do y'all find, do you have time for that? And what's that like? And are the actors very, you know, into that idea or whatever? I mean, like, just tell me a little bit about it. I just wonder, like, is there time for you guys to shoot for your own personal pleasure on these sets that you're working on?
Well, you're always, I mean, in my case, I'm always carrying a film camera with me at all times. And you have to remember that when you're producing a show or writing a show or creating a show, you're involved with these people from the very beginning. It's not like you just, hey, you're on set. You've cast them, you've met with them, you've talked to them, you've told them how you work. So you've had sort of a relationship with them already. Mm-hmm. So shooting, knowing, like, every actor saw my camera, we would shoot all the time in between. And it was never like invasive. It was always like, oh, let's go shoot. Or they would suggest to me, oh, let's go shoot. And someone who really loved doing that was Peter Dinklage. And Peter was on our show, Life as We Know It. And then we did a pilot with him. And it was one of those things, like, we would have a break and Peter, you know, would just, I go, let's go shoot. We go shoot somewhere. And they're my favorite portraits. And I've put out one, but I haven't put out any of that. But if I do a book, I mean, that would be, you know, there's people like that, that I've shot portrait of that just, they're so giving as human beings. Mm. And that comes through. I feel like when, you know, it's every show I've done, film photography of the actors and awesome. Crew.
That's very awesome. Jeff, you got any comments on that one?
I wish I had done more film photography on the first few shows I did. And I really didn't. It would be great to have a documentation of that first year on Friends. It would be pretty incredible because nobody else had. Similarly on Will and Grace. I have some, you know, digital camera photos from those two shows, particularly Will and Grace. But it was around the time that I started directing that I got in the habit of loading an Olympus Pen EE3, which is a half-frame film camera. I would load it with Ilford XP2 Super, and I would keep it in my back pocket all the time because it's a camera you can work with one hand. You don't even have to look through the viewfinder. It's basically a point and shoot. And so I would just have it around. And so when I was directing, I would document the run-through, or I would document the makeup trailer, or I would document the camera crew, or I would document the craft service table. And it was so unobtrusive and so quiet, and I was able to do my job without having to stop and put a camera to my eye and focus and think. And half frame is, I mean, I never had to reload because I would have 72 shots on a roll. And so I just got in the habit of just shooting, and I do it all the time now. I never am on set without that camera on my little director stand. And it's really organic and easy. I don't really ever even pose anybody. Most of the time, I'm just interested in seeing, like, when the writers gather between takes to rewrite a line, or when the actors are laughing, like, you know, off with the makeup person when they're touching up their hair. I think those moments are so privileged and so interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm in a position to capture them, maybe, and this sort of echoes what Gabe is saying, maybe in a way that the set photographer is not. Because I think when the set photographer is there, they're aware this is going to be used for CBS press.
Yeah.
This is going to be used to promote the show. Mm-hmm. I'm just an amateur. I'm just like there taking snapshots. And sometimes I'll post one or two of those shots on Instagram, but they're really just for me. And I think that makes it more intimate and a little bit more spontaneous.
Well, yep.
Actors are always aware when they're being photographed.
And Jeff, so for you on that, because I've flirted with half frame multiple times throughout my analog photography quote unquote career. And when it comes to half frame, there's two sort of paradigms that you can take. Either the fact that you have got 72 frames, forget the fact that you have any semblance of limitation, because 72 for a film photographer is such a mind-blowingly large number that you just shoot without any restriction.
Yeah.
Or the other side of the spectrum is that you are shooting with the diptych in mind.
Sure.
When you are doing that kind of thing, where along that spectrum do you lie? And I'll tack on an additional side of this question to Gabe, because if you're saying that you are mainly reaching for, let's say, your M6 with something like a 35 Summicron, what are some of the factors that go into that decision? Because that's a very different camera choice in terms of capturing moments that are happening, you know, in making conscious choices of the gear that you're using, which for people who are gear obsessed is half of the fun, is right. What gear to use for a certain circumstance. So first to you, Jeff, and then we'll kind of transition.
Sure. It's interesting you're talking about the diptych of it all, because sometimes I do have that in the back of my mind. I'll shoot more shots in an attempt to get just a little mini sequence going, and not just a diptych, but like twos, threes, and fours.
Mm-hmm.
There was an episode of The Neighborhood I directed where Cedric has to do a fall and Max has to catch him. And Cedric is a big guy. So when we were rehearsing that, I was very aware of, like, I want to try and get a version of the fall as a sequence. So sometimes I'm thinking about that, or sometimes I'm thinking I want to take a picture of the slate and then I want to take a picture of the scene so that I'll have that juxtaposition in a diptych. But most of the time, my head is in directing the show. So it's just a very, very distant sort of idea of how to document it in a way that might potentially be interesting. It's not, there's not that much thought.
Before you talk about kind of gear choice and why the M6 and the 35 Summicron, Gabe, to that point that Jeff just made in terms of like trying to find that balance, because in a lot of cases, you are directing. You have to pay attention to what the hell you're doing. How do you strike that balance between doing your job and the fun side? Like, well, potential, like, I'm gonna bring the camera from around here and I'm still covering this and take a photo.
Yeah, I mean, look, we have a very warm set. We sort of have rules. Excuse me. There's no yelling on our sets, and we don't have, like, it's a very different sort of experience. So I will have to answer and do my job, and then I will take my camera out. I mean, there's a lot of work. And I think, you know, just talking about while it's on my mind, the 35 and the M6 is, I like to get I like you to know that you're behind the scenes. So I like to get the camera into the shot. I like to get, you know, what's going on, you know, all that kind of stuff, I think is you know, really important. And I also like to get perspectives that are, that you don't see every day. So we had these big film cameras on Freaks and Geeks, and we were shooting, I think, two cameras one day in the middle of, we were somewhere in Santa Clarita, I believe, I'm not sure. And it's just from behind our three boys to the entire set. Like, Judd's giving them a note, Jeff's giving a note, and you see the entire crew and you see everything. And it's sort of those perspectives that I really love. And I love people to see, like, what it is. And then with sets, I think that, you know, there's a shot that sort of every magazine has used that I've taken about, it's the three boys. It's the three geeks. It's a portrait looking down on them sitting on a curb. But it was just in between takes. It was like we had a little, longer setup. So we were just all outside talking, and they were just sitting together on the curb. So I took about 20 shots of them just goofing around. And that one of them all just sort of looking up like that is the one that Vanity Fair and a bunch of companies use. But it's just, and the more you do it, the more that relationship, they know it's very easy. It's not, you know, there's no annoyance, which is nice.
It sounds to me like, if you guys don't come out with either, singularly or together, a gigantic photo book, that you're really goofing in life at this point, right?
Well, I love that.
Yeah.
That's something that I would be so honored to have on my shelf, especially, like, you know, I've had the pleasure of meeting Jeff in person once for the briefest, like, 10 minutes, but, you know, being so privileged to be in the same city as you guys, and hopefully now that we're turning the corner on this just awful, awful pandemic, to meet you guys in person and hopefully craft a deeper personal relationship and friendship. Yeah. It's like, cool. The thing that means the most to me, whether it's stuff that I have from Mike or things that are sent in by the listeners, are owning things and putting things on my shelf from my friends. And already I consider you guys, like, we're getting into the Andre love rant part of the
Andre has been drinking tonight, and we're starting to see that.
I've been drinking a lot tonight. But if you guys ever do decide to, put together something like that, I really do think that you have an extremely unique perspective. And whatever format that comes out in, like, please do know that it will be absolutely valued, and that for whatever it's worth, it will have a very special place on my bookshelf.
Cool. Okay. Well, yeah. There might be a prototype that I could show you of a Freaks and Geeks book of all my stuff,
man.
But I'm just saying there may be one, but I may be able to show you.
Nice.
Just a photo book of people at the craft services table would be incredible.
Right.
Just doing that, I would love.
The thing that anybody that I'm in a relationship with has to kind of deal with at some point is realizing that one of my favorite shots of people, it doesn't matter, where it is, who it is. If you matter to me, I will take a photo of you mid-bite. And those
that's the thing, is it's such a good shot of people. So just everyone at the craft table, I think, would be great.
The least flattering photo you can take of somebody, and it's the ones that mean the most to me. You know that you have made it into my inner circle if I made you a darkroom print of you biting into a piece of food.
Perfect.
Well, I will say this.
I'll let you take all the shots of me eating soup.
I'm glad that my wife did not take a photo of me eating the raw oysters.
No.
Just licking it out of the shell, like.
No, there was something going off those oysters. There was something going off.
Something wrong.
All right. Well, I think it's about time for us to wrap this one up.
Jeff Greenstein.
I have a special thing for you, Mike. If you're okay with this,
I don't know what this is, but I'm fine with this.
Well, all right. It's.
I need to preface this by saying that I am not a musician.
Uh-oh. Oh my goodness!
It is your 50th birthday. It was your 50th birthday when this podcast began.
It did.
It is in your time still.
Yeah, that's right. It's still your 50th birthday. So I have penned a little song, and Gabe is going to accompany me on the bongos, I believe.
Oh, my goodness.
Here we go.
Am I right about that, Gabe? Are you ready?
Yes.
And this is with love to Mike.
That's unbelievable.
I am not a guitarist. I can't believe I'm doing this for an actual.
I am not one either. So I just play one.
From Gabe.
From
Jabe. Let's see. My plumber's towed in a Pentax K. Let me try one more time. My plumber's towed in a Pentax K. Cause of my gutter man. APS sales have tripled. They sold 3 rolls. Blame it on gutter man. Andre's got a fifth of Jack in his desk. Wants to be like the gutter man. Ford's got a new slogan. It's Build Mike Tough. They love the gutter man. We all love the gutter man. Happy birthday, my gutter man.
Oh. Happy birthday.
That was so good.
Oh my goodness. I gotta say,
my
that
cheeks
is,
so hurt. That was really sweet.
That is gonna go down as when this podcast ever ends, that's gonna go down as one of my favorite moments. And thank you guys for
happy birthday.
That was amazing. I am blown away and just humbled, and my heart is warmed, and it was hilarious, and I loved it. Thanks, that was amazing. Thank you.
That really was, guys. Thank you so much for that. And you know, Mike, you're so loved in this community. So it shouldn't come as a surprise. I didn't see it coming, but like, it's a feeling that everybody has. Unless you're a particular kind of person that takes a particular sort of issue with some of the language of the podcast, or maybe you listen to the Pontiac Fiero episode of the Classic Lenses podcast, a little bit of a snowflake. 99% of people that listen to our show or anything that Mike Gutterman is on realize how wonderful of a human being he is. Oh, really, Mike, thank you. Thank you for not, you know, killing yourself with cigarettes for 50 years. hopefully you can cut that shit out so that we can enjoy you for many, many more. And truly, we love you, man.
Oh, man. Thank you. Wow. I tell you what, man, like, I had kind of a non-eventful birthday, but this just really made it, man. And like, that just made my birthday. I just really appreciate it. Like, wow. That, you know, turning 50, not so bad. I'm kind of over the fear of getting old, but, you guys just really, made it special. I appreciate that. Like, I can't thank you guys enough. I'm blown away. So,
thanks for having us. We're honored to be on the 50th birthday episode. Are you
absolutely? Yeah. My wife was like, you know, it's your birthday. Why did you schedule a podcast on your birthday? Well, you don't understand. I got some real cool guys coming on. So, you know, yeah. So no better people I'd want to spend my birthday with. So, so there you go. But, I don't know how to end the show now, all right. So let's get some socials out. Jeff, and Gabe, thank you guys so much. Not only for your appearance, but the wonderful, the Pearl Jam medley.
Has anyone ever done that before? I just want to make sure.
I've never heard
a Gutterman song tune of Better Man.
No, I've never. I used to. That song was pretty big when me and my wife was dating, and I would tell her that, you know, I would sing Gutterman to her. But no one besides me, I think, has praised me through that song quite like that, other than myself. So, all right. So let's go ahead and get our socials out again. Thanks, guys. It's been amazing. But Jeff, where can people check you out?
I am S. Jeff Greenstein on Instagram. I'm Blue439 on Twitter. Obviously, I Dream of Cameras on Instagram as well. That's the Instagram for our podcast.
Awesome. And Gabe?
I am at Gabe Sachs on Instagram. And of course, I Dream of Cameras. So that's it. That's where you can find me.
Awesome. And Jess, where can people check you out?
You can find me at Yes Jones on Instagram. I'm in the Facebook group as Jessica Jones. And that's about it. I think I forgot about the other app. Oh, God, what's that chat app that we have now? Clubhouse. I can't remember the name. It's a thing of the past already. Clubhouse. I'm Yes Jones, but I'm not on there.
Nice. And Andre, where can people see you?
At Andre on Film on Instagram. I'll probably be deleting everything and starting over from scratch in a couple weeks. Don't hold me to that. But I'm in the Facebook group every once in a while, and you can find me on Clubhouse once in a blue moon.
Very cool. All right, you can see me on Instagram at Gutterman Photo, on Facebook at Mike Gutterman Photography. You can email this program at negpositives@gmail.com. You can join the Facebook group, the Negative Positives Film Photo Podcast Facebook group. We also have an Instagram account under the account name Negative Positives, mostly ran by Mrs. Roxana Angles. If you submit photos to Instagram, think about using the hashtag Negative Positives. And maybe Roxana will see it and highlight it for all of us to check out. You can support this program on Ko-fi. It is ko-fi.com/negativepositives. And then we have a merch site that is negativepositivespodcast.bigcartel.com, which I am going to be having an APS t-shirt coming on online soon.
Yeah.
Designed by Mr. Johnny Sisson from the Classic Lenses podcast. He has designed me an APS. It has a Kodak APS camera on it. It says it has the APS logo, and it says the hottest trend in film photography on it, Negative Positives Podcast. So So that will be hopefully I'll get that up on the merch site in the next week or so. But a huge thanks to Johnny Sisson for helping me out with that one. So Johnny's always in for a good funny t-shirt. So but all right, folks, everyone have a great week. Again, huge thanks to Jeff Greenstein and Gabe Sachs for joining us tonight. And yeah, everybody have a great week. Everybody stay positive.
And shoot some cool film photos.
Do it now.
Oh, gosh. Thanks, Jabe.
Jabe. I think it has to be the band name for that Pearl Jam cover, I think, is Jabe.
I know.
Yeah, so.
Jabe.
Jabe sounds a lot better than Geff.
It does. It's better. It's way better.
All right, folks. We'll talk to you soon. A Gutter Man Cave production.